The brewery is known for its big beers and bigger personalities, and James is a perfect fit for them. Bringing knowledge to the organization, James helps us understand why the brewery continues to go big on its beers, discusses the three brands of the organization, including their sour brewery and hazy brewery, and we talk about the changes within the industry that he's seen and what the future can hold for updating craft beer laws and what we can expect from the brewery in the future. All this and more on this episode of Better on Draft.
Whether your beer is in a bottle, can, or glass, kick back and relax. It's Better on Draft.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 306 of the Better on Draft podcast. My name is Ken. Thank you so much for joining us. We were off the last 2 weeks. Definitely had a lot of fun. We'll probably talk about it during the news segment, but let's get to it, starting with our co-host, Wendy. What are you drinking?
I am drinking a Happy Belgian-style ale from the brewery Mischief.
All right, Robert, what about you?
So I am sipping on kind of my usual concoctions, first up being the Untitled Arts Chocolate Milk Dark Brew, which is one of their non-alcoholics, and also the combo of the ginger beer along with Kentucky 74, the non-alcoholic bourbon. So I make myself a little cocktail.
All right, and Dan, what do you got?
Oh, man, we're going to have some fun tonight. I've got the usual vodka soda going on, re-upped on that Stoli. And then we're going to kind of get crazy and crack open this Black Tuesday in a little bit.
Damn.
I myself have a nice pour of Black Tuesday in my Better on Draft glass. And I'm going to be washing it down with a can of Mischief. In studio, live with us from the brewery, we have James. James, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us what you do over at the brewery and what you're drinking.
Yeah, thanks for having me here on this Friday evening. It's only 4 p.m. here in California, but it's happy hour everywhere. I'm drinking our offshoot hazy IPA called Relax, and I also have it backed up by our Hoppy Belgian Mischief, and I have a much smaller pour of Black Tuesday for everyone because it contains lots of alcohol.
So you're not drinking a whole bottle? Is that what you're telling me?
That's why mine's not open.
He's probably still got to drive home.
I do eventually have to drive home. And then, yes, my role here at the brewery is director of production. I oversee all of our different projects, offshoot, the brewery, Brewery Taru, and all of the associated brands.
Let's talk about offshoot for a second. What is the reasoning that the brewery decided to open another brewery and make that style almost specifically for offshoot?
Yeah, originally when the brewery was founded, just like a lot of other really cool craft beer people, we thought that we would never make an IPA. Patrick Rue is... very famous for saying he would never make an IPA, the same as Monkish down here in Southern California. And, you know, as an offshoot on the pilot system, they would start making some of these IPAs to drink because they thought they needed something else that wasn't going to bust your face off. I mean, we had Mischief. It's still a great beer, but it's still 8.5%. And it's still got a little bit of those Belgian phenols and esters, but we wanted like the everyday drinkers. And that's kind of where offshoot came from. We started iterating some of those beers and just pouring them in the tasting room as an offshoot of the brewery. And then eventually we trademarked the brewery name offshoot and started canning and producing beers under that label. It's now a good portion of our production. It's kind of more than half, but just barely. So
now on the website, thebrewery.com, it does say your favorite beer is Mischief. Is that still
it
correct?
Is.
Okay. And what's your favorite offshoot beer though?
I have to go with Escape, the Everyday West Coast IPA. That's probably my favorite. I'm more of a bitter IPA kind of person. I do like the hazies as well. I love where they fit into the IPA market. They're there for a reason. They get people that don't like the bitterness to actually enjoy hops. So I think that they serve a good purpose, and they're delicious when they're done right. I think we do them right. But at the same time, yeah, I'm more of a bitter person, even though I'm drinking the hazy right now. So
now you've had a long journey in the industry of craft beer, and your journey at the brewery is actually fairly new. What are some of the reasons that made you want to join the organization?
Yeah, it is a long journey. Is that the cue that I could talk about my long journey to get here?
Of course.
Okay. Yeah, so I started in the beer industry over a decade ago at a brewery in Florida called Proof Brewing Company. I had a biology degree from my undergrad and was just kind of like working bar jobs because I graduated during that wonderful mid-2000s Great Recession. And I couldn't really find a good job, but ended up working at Proof Brewing Company as security. And then they're like, oh, you have a biology degree. Do you want to come work in this brewery that we're opening up downstairs? It worked out. It afforded me the opportunity to get my foot in at the ground level at a small place. We were a 3-barrel brew house at the time. Helped them grow into their newer 15-barrel production facility. This was around 2012, 2013, and really kind of got my feet wet in the industry. But it was, you know, back in the days when you had the clean kegs for free for like 6 months before they paid you, and then after that, you're getting just barely more than minimum wage. So wasn't super psyched to be doing that and having to work 2 or 3 jobs. So ended up finding a job at Terrapin in Athens, Georgia. The makers of Hops Kuchner, Wake and Bake, stuff like that. Worked there for almost 3 years, became like the barrel lead and, you know, went from 15,000 barrels a year to almost 70,000 barrels a year at Terrapin while I was there. So I saw super fast growth, learned a lot, met my wife also while I was there. So she was getting her master's at UGA. And when she graduated, she got a job outside of Atlanta, which is about an hour and a half from Athens. So didn't seem feasible to make that drive. And I ended up finding a new job as the head brewer at the then startup Scofflaw Brewing in Atlanta, Georgia. They have grown considerably since their inception. But I didn't really jive with ownership there. And I made it about a year there. I installed the brew house, installed the glycol, you know, did almost 10,000 barrels of production with 2 brewers on a 15-barrel brew house that first year. So it was a lot of work. I learned a lot of what to do and what not to do when you start a brewery. So it was a great learning experience. Left there and was working at Sweetwater in Atlanta, Georgia for about 3 years. I think they're top 15 craft brewers in the country, about 270,000 barrels a year when I was there, which is pretty crazy. They recently just got bought by a cannabis company out of Canada, which is pretty cool for them. But I think I helped get them there because I created some beers like the G13 and the Mango Kush when I was there. It was a good time. It was a fun place to work. Again, I learned a lot. But the head brewer, I've been there over 15 years and weren't really going anywhere. So me as the lead was just kind of left to my own devices. I ended up applying to grad school, having the brewmaster there write me a recommendation letter at UC Davis. got accepted, was the first graduate student under the new professor there, Glenn Fox, that followed up Charlie Bamforth. Pretty cool. Did my thesis on beer, the interactions of hops and yeast during the fermentation of beer. Got a master's in food science. While I was there, I was working packaging at Budweiser there in Fairfield, California, which was an amazing experience to see that much beer, you know, flowing. We would do about 60 cases a minute, which is, if you guys can imagine that, that's just a huge amount.
Wow.
And yeah. So, and that was one of three packaging lines running at one time. So, it was pretty impressive. But yeah. And then also worked quality at Lagunitas while I was in grad school. Out of grad school, actually, while I was still finishing up there, I was applying to jobs in the industry, and I applied to be the innovation manager here at the brewery. So right after Andrew Bell left, he went on to start Radiant Beer here in Anaheim. They won Great American Beer Festival Brewery of the Year last year for their small size. But I also applied at Creature Comforts to run their Los Angeles facility that they are starting up, and ended up kind of like having both of those job offers, and eventually decided to actually go with Creature Comforts, not the brewery, which is kind of anticlimactic for where we're going here, but worked there for about a year. And we were just caught up in red tape, and just, I wasn't super psyched on the fact that I wasn't doing any production. I was doing more construction management. And I just wanted to get back into beer. But lo and behold, the CEO here at the brewery, Barry Holmes, came and hit me up because the production director was going on to start his own brewery, which seems to be a common thread from people here at the brewery. And yeah, I was offered the director of production in May of this year, took it in June, and have been here since. It's been a pretty wild ride, but yeah, that's the last 15 years of my life summed up in about 5 minutes.
Perfect. So before I pass it off to Wendy, I want to talk about the beer that I'm drinking right now, which is the Mischief. Obviously, you mentioned, you know, the styles of beer that the brewery was making, and this was kind of a offshoot beer that they made. What was the idea that went into this beer? And what it does say hoppy Belgian style ale at 8.5%. Like, what flavor and like what am I getting from this beer as I'm drinking it?
Yeah, Mischief in general is it's kind of a nod to the past of what the brewery was founded on, the Belgian style ales, while bringing in kind of that new taste of California and of the new school hops. So it's a dry hopped Belgian strong ale. It's used the same yeast that Patrick Roux first isolated off some cans of Duvel back in, you know, the early 2000s, and we're still using it today, 15 years later. And yeah, we just wanted to make something hoppy because the changing tastes of the general clientele. And we also enjoyed it. I like it because it does that both things. It mixes the old school flavor of a Belgian ale, which not many people are making anymore. Gives you those awesome, like, peppery phenols and like fruity esters, but also gives you some nice, like, punchy, grassy, dank, catty hop notes too. It's got Motu Eka and Citra in it, so some fun hops. Yeah.
Wendy, it's on to you.
I totally agree that it is the perfect blending of both worlds. As somebody who is hop timid and doesn't like the punch you in the face West Coast styles of the IPAs, I enjoy this one actually a lot. So my question, I guess, totally just left my mind. That's horrible. It's like I'm brand new. how is it that you Do you still have a, I'm sorry. Do you still have like an input? You said that when you were with Sweetwater, you helped them with a couple of different styles. Do you still have input in the actual brewing, or is it more just the production stuff?
Oh, I mean, so production is brewing. I am in charge of brewing. I'm in charge of the cellar. I'm in charge of packaging. I'm in charge of the quality lab. I'm in charge of the barrel cellar, all of that. So that I'm oversee all of that. And actually, I am the one that does the large majority of the recipe development. There's a team of us that kind of all kind of work together. And we have a pretty bitchin' pilot system here, like a little three barrel system with 11 fermenters and three brights, which is bigger than some small craft breweries. So we get to do a lot of like fun testing of new recipes. And it's kind of like an iteration series. So we go from the pilot and we go direct to tasting room at three barrel mark, you know, a couple kegs for them, and we'll test a few kegs. And then we also have a membership program, two different levels, a hoarder society that's invite only and a reserve society that is actually open for enrollment right now. But you get to make new, fun, and exciting beers just for them, because, you know, they're into all those new, fun, exciting things. They want all the crazy flavors. And we have all kinds of bottles where we do just weird stuff. This is a collaboration with Firestone Walker called Mojitarita. It's basically a agave-fed wheat wine that was aged in tequila barrels, then has limes, peppermint, orange peel, and sea salt. This beer is only going to members because that's the perks of becoming a member. So that allows us to iterate even further. It's a little bit bigger than the pilot. We'll do like, you know, 5 to 15 barrels of those beers. And if those become good enough, then they'll make it into like small scale direct-to-consumer distribution. So we have a pretty good online presence there too. And then if that gets even better, then it goes to distribution on a bigger scale. So we distribute to, I think right now, 30 states. So
what is one beer that you have been a part of or are working on now that you're really excited about?
Ooh, really excited about. I think that's a hard question to ask because it's so many like babies that I'm bringing into this world. On the offshoot side, we got a seasonal beer coming out in January called Oasis that I'm super psyched on. We're going to be using some hops here that the brewery has never really used before, stuff like Riwaka, Sultana, and you know, some fun other fruity hops, Azaka, and we're gonna, you know, do some new techniques, something called dip hopping that they've never really messed with here. And that's kind of cool to introduce the people here to some new fun stuff that I've learned over the years. That's the offshoot side. On the brewery side, I mean, we're gonna keep doing barrel aged stouts. We got a rum barrel aged stout that we're going to make with strawberries and cocoa nibs next year, coming out in January. It's super exciting. Yeah. super exciting. And then, you know, we're also kind of going to go back to basics a little bit, and, you know, not everything has to be 18 to 20% punch you in the face. So we're going to do a couple 4% beers in January as well. I'm pretty excited about those. It's kind of never ending. We have a propensity here at the brewery to do a lot of different things, which is fun. And I think we do all of them very well. I am trying to rein that in a little bit. Like this year, by the end of 2022, we will have done 245 different beers. which is quite nice. quite impressive because that's like 3 or 4 a week. I'm going to bring that back down to only like 160 next year. So it's still like 2 a week, but it's going to be nicer to focus a little bit more on some of them and put a little bit more time and effort into them. So
before I pass it over to Dan, I'm curious. I am a big fan of traveling, and I always try to go and visit different breweries when I'm in my travels. Sometimes I specifically am traveling just to go to the brewery. Why should we come and visit you?
Like I said, we have those direct to tasting room beers that you're only going to find here. And if you sweet talk the bartenders down there enough, they'll let you sample some of the members' beers also. At any given time, we got about 40 different beers on tap that we're pouring, and probably about 100 different beers in package that you can take home with you at the same time too. So it's kind of an exciting experience. And we've been around for 14, 15 years almost at this point. So I think we're kind of one of those old school stalwarts in the Southern California industry that have actually created a lot of other brewers and brands that have gone on to do great things. So it's kind of also very cool to see where they come from.
Awesome. Dan?
All right. I'm glad you brought up traveling, Wendy. So a lot of people don't realize Anaheim actually has a pretty good beer scene. At least in my opinion, it's a little bit better than the spread out way that LA is. Talk to us a little bit about how your brewery fits in there. That came up a couple of weeks ago is McKellar just closed another location out in San Francisco. And we were talking, you know, it's just kind of there. Do you feel like the brewery kind of falls into that, especially with some of the breweries that are around your area?
I don't think we're just kind of here. I mean, like I said, we've been here for almost 15 years. We definitely are one of the first in this area, and we help to usher that. That being said, we're not actually in Anaheim. We're in the city is called Placentia. It's right next to Anaheim, but in between Anaheim and Fullerton. But yes, this Orange County, I think, has a pretty cool beer scene in general. We got, you got Green Cheek is crushing things. Beachwood's got a location here in Huntington Beach that's doing great. You have Everywhere Beer Company that just opened up from a lot of the guys that came from here. Like I said, Radiant earlier, is in Anaheim. There's smaller players like Juniper and Morgan that's right down the street from us. There's bigger players like, Brewery X, that's right around the corner from us. And they got, you know, beer in Angel Stadium. There's boutique stuff and second locations. Chapman Crafted is pretty great. They're in this general area. You have, you know, Monkish has an outpost here in Anaheim. Modern Times just closed their outpost here in Anaheim, which is a little bit disappointing, but you know, we can drive an hour down to Oceanside still. It's not that big a deal.
I'm surprised you didn't mention Bottle Logic of all the breweries you mentioned there. Every time I'm there, I'm like, I'm going to make it up to the brewery after this and then end up stumbling somewhere and forgetting what I'm doing.
Yeah, well, Bottle Logic is, we're doing a collaboration stout with them last year. They were just in the brewery here like 3 weeks ago. They didn't slip my mind. I'm sorry. Sorry, Wes.
Rob would be definitely disappointed. Yeah.
I'm okay. I'm pretty much going to say that, you know, I was in Anaheim last year, and I definitely was without a doubt standing over Bottle Logic. That I knew you guys were there, and I never got up there to go to brewery. So I'm definitely mad at myself for not going.
If you're ever at Bottle Logic again. There's also low-key the best draft list in all of Southern California is at a homebrew shop right across the street called Windsor Homebrew Supply.
Oh.
Check it out. It's the biggest collection of Trefontaine and Cantillon in Southern California as well. So
yeah, the crazy thing is that I was driving and parked right at that side of the street, and I never even looked at that side of the street. I just immediately was so focused on bottle logic.
Okay.
It's easy to, Yeah, that's easy to happen there. My next question, you know, looking at this Black Tuesday, you know, this is 19.7%. There aren't a lot of beers that go that high. The only one I can think of off the top of my head is Worldwide Stout from Dogfish Head. What's the reasoning? And I noticed a lot of your beers are up there above 15% and even going up to here. What's the reasoning behind that? Why are we going so high on some of these? Are these beers you're making to have once in a while, or what's the reasoning behind it?
A lot of the beer that we put in bottles is very much like a celebratory occasion, but at the same time, you know, meant to be drank on any given Tuesday. Black Tuesday kind of got its name because it was a very bad brew, stuck mash that all ended up all over the floor of the brew house. But the wort that came off was like super high gravity, and you know, we threw the Belgian house culture at it. At the time, I think in the early years, they were actually using maple syrup to feed it during fermentation to boost the ABV. We use just regular dextrose now, but the intention was always to make this huge beer that would go into a bourbon barrel. And Patrick Rue really wanted to just like have this huge in your face stout that could hold up to like some of the best spirits in the world. And that's kind of the intention. It's meant to go into barrels. When it comes off the fermenter, well, okay, we'll start here. When it comes off the brew house, it's 28 Plato, meaning 28% sugar. We feed it with sugar three times during fermentation, and it gets it up to about 35% sugar. And then from the Belgian yeast that we use, it gets down to about 2% sugar. So it's really low residual sugar, super dry. It doesn't taste like it when you taste it, which is pretty impressive. But it also has like Mischief, because it is the same yeast as Mischief, a lot of those Belgian phenols, spicy notes, some of those like weird dark fruit characters that kind of don't really jive until they've been in a bourbon barrel for about 10 months. And we put it in a barrel and we don't even touch it. And it's variable year to year, right? So this year's Black Tuesday is 19.7. Last year's, I think, was 19.2. It's going into the barrel about 18% alcohol, but it's going to pick up, you know, spirits, residual spirits from the wood. It's going to pick up extra alcohol from its time in the barrel. And you know, the temperature swings that we see in our warehouse, we do climate control it, but it's not like air conditioned. It's just like, so it doesn't get to 100 degrees in the middle of summer like it can do here in Southern California. And yeah, it's going to evaporate at different rates based on the viscosity, based on like the pores in the wood. So it kind of all blends together and it comes up with what you're doing. So year to year, it can be variable. 19.7 is not the biggest beer we did this year. The Black Tuesday Reserve is sitting at around 22% this year. We do the Grand Reserve. The Reserve is double barrel, so we'll age it for a year in bourbon barrels, put it into new bourbon barrels for another year. Yeah, and then bottle it. The Grand Reserve, which is triple barreled, comes in around almost 24-25%. So if you're really looking for the heat, that's where you should go.
On it. So yeah, Rob's like, I'm doing this. Now, you were talking about the memberships that you have there. Something I noticed that's interesting are the beer wine hybrids that you do, that you seem to only do for members. What's been the reception for that? Have people enjoyed that, or talk to us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I think we only sell them to members because they're a little bit esoteric. I'm really trying to push the term Eno beer because we're not allowed to say wine on the label for these things, according to the Tax and Trade Bureau. Yeah, I think the reception is generally good. From a beer drinker, it tastes like wine. From a wine drinker, it tastes like beer. They usually are sitting at around 49% wine and 51% beer. So we'll press the grapes and get the juice, and we'll co-ferment it with Black Tuesday or any other base beer. Black Tuesday is our big one, but yeah, I think in a general sense, people love them. I mean, that's the reason people become members. They love the experimentation we do. Yeah, overall, pretty good reception.
Excellent. Glad to hear it. It's something I don't think I would try unless someone just handed me a glass of it. That's why I was kind of curious if people actually do go about buying this. Now, Rob, I believe you had a question next.
Oh, yeah. And I will just, I guess, first start off by saying that I was first introduced into the brewery from having my first glass being Black Tuesday. And that pretty much, in my head, you know, the whole damn song, the whole new world was just going on in my damn head as I was drinking this thing. It was unbelievable. And it's still one of my favorites. But I guess kind of going back to you and the job. So I believe that you've been the director now, what is it, 5 months?
About 5 months.
So what's been kind of like the most, I don't even want to talk about what the most exciting aspect of the job is. What's something about the job that, you know, general people just really don't know is something that you do?
Aside from the fact that I'm in meetings a lot of the day, what we have to do here as me being the director of production, what I tend to do is spend a lot of my time being like the liaison between the production team and our sales channels, whether it's direct to consumer or our distribution, and like right sizing our production volumes so that we're not overproducing and sitting on a bunch of beer that we can't sell, or we're not underproducing and like missing out on those opportunities to sell the beer. So there's a lot of like dealing with spreadsheets that probably people don't really think that happens. And probably honestly that I didn't really think I would do 13 years ago when I started brewing beer. But I guess after grad school, you get pretty good at spreadsheets. So yeah, it's clerical just as much as it's hands-on. So.
Yeah. Now, kind of going into your background and going from East Coast to West Coast, obviously there's trends that we have on the East being, you know, New England IPAs, and then trends on the West being usually West Coast IPAs. But is there kind of a trend, any type of trends that are going on in the West Coast that you feel that the East Coast is missing out on?
I think cold IPAs are probably starting to hit over there on the East Coast, but they're
We've got a couple, not a lot.
They're definitely pretty big out here now. I mean, that's what the West Coast likes to do. They like to iterate on the IPA. The Brut IPA came and went really quick. But I think the cold IPA has a lot of staying power just because it's takes all of those things that you wanted of a Brut IPA, like crisp and dry, but like offers in a lot of the techniques that we've learned from making hazy IPAs, like, you know, late edition hopping and super juicy and all of that, and kind of combines them together to this like great package. You know, Highland Park Brewing up in LA does it really well. They use lager yeast on every single IPA that they make at this point. And they're some of the best IPAs, not just in, you know, Southern California, but in the country. I think Southern California swept the GABF category for American IPA this year. So, you know, North Park down in San Diego, they're also killing it. We're not on the train of the super fruited sours as much as the East Coast, I will say. But I'm not even sure if the East Coast is really on that train anymore. Are people still making the smoothie sours out there? Some.
I would agree. There's a few.
Yeah, there's a few. And speaking of GABF, I did see that you guys won silver for Ivoire, for the under the wood and barrel aged strong beer category. So congrats on that. I believe that's like, is that your 12th or 13th medal that you guys have won from GABF?
I don't even know the total. They're all out here hanging on the wall right outside my office, and I've never counted them. So
is it true that next thing to do after getting an award like that is just to go on and get the next one?
Yeah, I mean, that's the plan. That's the hope, the dream. We're going to keep entering beers and at least the World Beer Cup and the Great American Beer Festival and maybe a few other competitions throughout the year. But I think that it brings recognition and it brings validation to what you're making. That beer in particular is pretty awesome. For it to win a medal, finally, one of our anniversary beers. I sent that to you guys. I'm surprised no one's drinking it. This is.
I'm holding that one, holding off on that one for a little bit.
I can't do that one by myself.
Fair enough.
you can if you spend the entire day.
Well, yeah. one of the things he said is that, you know, a lot of the beers that the brewery makes are shareable beers. These are beers that mm-hmm. are meant to be shared. And while we are on a beer podcast, we're in, you know, five different cities and five different areas right now to where we can't necessarily share. So for me, like we're having a Friendsgiving type event tomorrow. So that, you know, those bigger bottles minus the Black Tuesday I cracked open today is going to get open tomorrow for them. So all my friends awesome. That are excited to come and don't realize what they're in for. You know, a few of them, nice. maybe some nights on the couch. That's for sure. Sorry, Rob. Go on.
That's all right. I was going to say if there's one that I would definitely not share, which I heard about while listening to the United We Drink podcast episode that you were on about the Vanilla Reserve, which was using 17 types of vanilla and double barrel aged. I want that bottle and I'm not sharing it. So I'm telling people right now, if I get my hands on that, I'm not sharing it.
I think we're out of that one. So good luck finding one.
Yeah, let's see what I can figure out. But I did see that, I guess kind of going into a little bit in terms of business and distribution, earlier this year, there was a state Senate bill, SB 620, that if it was going to pass, it would have allowed distilleries and breweries within and outside the state to ship directly consumers. I know that the bill's been amended and they took that part out. Now, and I guess Ken, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Michigan here is very similar, that beer shipped directly to consumers is not necessarily allowed.
Nope, not at all.
Now, the Brewers Association conducted a poll finding that craft beer drinkers would love direct-to-consumer shipping, but from a business perspective, how do you think that would shape the beer landscape for you and the breweries around you?
We personally would love it. I think most breweries around us would also love it. We do. Currently in California, we are allowed to ship within the state of California direct to consumer. So we have that option, but we also have a store in the District of Columbia there, because they have laws that allow them to ship to even more places. So we can reach 13 states with direct to consumer shipping right now. With the current model. That being said, wine is allowed to ship to 47 states. So there's a lot of room for growth in that. And we had to find like a legal loophole by getting a store in the District of Columbia to make that happen. So it did allow us to get some more membership on the East Coast, which is pretty exciting. And we get to get some of those beers to our East Coast people. But yeah, I mean, if we were allowed to ship direct to consumer, I mean, we could effectively make a lot more of these really fun and exciting beers that, you know, really only hit a handful of people at a time. You know, we could make from, we could go from making like 5 barrels of something up to like, you know, 25 barrels. It'd be pretty fun. But yeah, I think, I don't know. It's, I know we're not supposed to talk politics, but yeah.
If when it's a relation to beer, it's we'll allow it.
We'll allow it. Yeah, I think yeah, it's kind of mind blowing. I mean, California's its own evil monster because we have like Gavin Newsom as the governor, and he owns a winery. There was all kinds of laws during COVID where like breweries had to serve food if you were to go to a brewery and drink beer, but wineries didn't. And a lot of people blame that on the fact that Gavin Newsom had his own winery. But yeah, I think we're a little bit more favorable here in California than other states. Like when I started my brewing career, I was in Florida and we thought it was like the craziest shit ever that we weren't allowed to have a 64-ounce growler. It could only be 32 or 128 ounces. And I was just like, wow, this is blasphemous. But then I moved to Georgia and we couldn't even sell a pint to a person at a brewery. We were not allowed. Like we had to sell a tour that came with 6 tickets for 6 6-ounce tastings. And if you didn't give them the tour, the Department of Revenue would come in and pull your license. And you weren't like the 3-tier system was just absurd when I was brewing there. I think about 2 years before I left the state, they finally opened it up. But even then, there was still like ridiculous laws. You weren't allowed to serve more than 3,000 barrels a year direct to consumer. So like at the time I was working at Sweetwater, we're making 270,000 barrels a year. We got a huge tasting room. Like there's breweries like New Realm there in Atlanta too. I don't understand how they weren't backing up against that 3,000 barrel cap. You also weren't allowed to sell kegs still. Like you weren't allowed to sell more than the volume of one case of beer, which I think is like 250, one case of 12 ounce beers, which I think is like 256 ounces. So you're not allowed to sell more than that. And obviously like that's, you know, just over 2 gallons. So I think you can't even sell a 5-gallon pony keg to someone versus like, yeah, here in California, like it's wild, wild west. You're allowed to almost do whatever you want as long as, yep, you know.
Yep. And my brother lives in Oakland, which is how I get my occasional shipment of Black Tuesday and nice. how I got Chocolate Rain.
So hey, we're not against proxies. You're allowed to have it. We got a member that flies a personal jet down from Montana to come pick up his beer. It's kind of absurd, but
it's amazing. All right, passing it to you, Ken.
Yeah, well, I do want to make one mention. As you discuss the state laws in Georgia, we actually had a decent conversation with Jason Santamaria from Second Self Beer, talking about those Georgia laws and how the changes that have happened throughout the years of him brewing over there, and you know, over the last just 8 years with him brewing over there, the way things have gone. So definitely go check that out. That episode was in September, I believe.
I listened to it. I knew him decently well. They were right around the corner from us when I worked at Scofflaw.
So. Awesome.
I was there often.
You know, you talked about proxies and stuff, and you know, the brewery has a lot of beers that are well sought out. And you do have your invite only membership. Is that to like, you know, separate maybe the people who are whale hunters that kind of, you know, only buy the big beers from you to only buy the big beers from you and don't purchase from you anymore? Or how does the differential occur between the two memberships other than just one's invite only?
Yeah, I'm not entirely privy to the way that they make the invitations to the Hoarder Society. But it definitely has to do a lot with like how often you're coming to the tasting room, how often you're buying you know, more things. And we kind of track that over the course of the year. And if we think that, like, you know, you'd be psyched to get these beers that we're only making, you know, 40 cases of, we kind of give you the invite, the little nod. We cap it, right? So we have to, we only give as many invites as people that end up leaving the Hoarder Society. Unfortunately, it does happen every year. It's about a 15% turnover rate, which is really low, but it's still like, you know, we'll only give out those amount of invites of the people that left. So
one of the things that I kind of have a love-hate relationship for, and that's Cellaring Beer. For those that, you know, followed us, especially for episode 300, we had a Flying Buffalo vertical, and all the beers actually held up so well. Now, for being someone who has come from a quality assurance background, because you have worked quality assurance within the brewery, what are your thoughts on how do you balance customer expectations when the beers necessarily aren't drank when purchased?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also, if you go back to like the question you asked about like why our beer is like 19%, a lot of those beers, and you know, and we've already done a lot of the aging for you, they're in a barrel for at least a year for the most part, like those tend to hold up really well. We have a really nice bottling line. You know, we're not hand bottling these beers one at a time off a bright tank like some smaller breweries. We have like a state-of-the-art Cosme bottling line that gets down in like the 50 parts per billion oxygen content within the within the bottle. We're putting it in like super durable German like champagne glass that's meant to withstand lots of time, stuff like that. So obviously, like, there's, I think the hard and fast rule that everyone seems to go for is like 8%. I would bump that almost to like 14%. If I was to hold onto a beer, I think that's when like those like oxidation characteristics aren't going to be like going against that. I do think that, you know, beers with a lot of adjuncts, meaning like if your stout has like marshmallows and cocoa nibs and vanilla and coffee and all these extra things, like those are going to tend to fall off way quicker. And not to say that we don't make beers like that. I mean, we totally do. There's definitely some ingredients that fall off quicker. But like something like Ivoire, that you were talking about earlier, that has beer technically in it that's 14 years old. It's Solera method. Like you take a portion of the last batch and you blend it into the next year's batch. And we've been doing that since the brewery started. And for it to have won a silver medal is pretty amazing, but you know, we build beers to do that. So yeah, I would say over 14%. I would say sour beers that have some active yeast still in them. So we do pasteurize some of our beers if they're under 16% and they have ingredients in them, any like adjunct ingredients like I was talking about, like marshmallows or nuts or whatever, we'll pasteurize those. Versus like if it's over that, we won't. And then our sour beers, we also don't pasteurize those because we think that those develop nicely in the bottle with the live culture that's in there. You know, I also do suggest don't just put it straight to a shelf, buy two, which is usually that's our hoarders people, right? They're buying one to drink now and they're hoarding one for later. so that you know, like the development. And if you don't think that it's going to develop well, I mean, just drink it now. Like that's, there's no problem with that. But from our standpoint, from a quality perspective, we actually do sensory on these beers. So on our core beers and anything that goes to distribution, we will do obviously pre-packaged, post-packaged sensory tasting. We'll do 30, 60, 90 days, both cold, ambient, and warm stored, all three of those to see how they develop and make sure that they'll still hold up. We got lots of evidence that says you should not store your beer warm, by the way. For some of these bigger bottled beers, we'll do 6, 9, 12 month tastings. We'll do 2 year tastings. We'll do 3 year tastings. And we'll pull it from sale when it gets to the point where we don't think, it can manage anymore. We just did a 10 year old Black Tuesday because October is Black Tuesday month. And it was fantastic. So I think some of our beers hold up really well. Like I said, I think it's above 14%, not the 8%. If they're packaged with active live yeast, like a sour beer, that's great. And adjuncts are going to fall off quickly. So don't expect this beer that tastes like maple syrup and pancakes to taste like maple syrup and pancakes 2 years from now. It's going to taste like earth and caramel probably.
All right, that's going to do it for episode 306. As we finish every episode, we go through the final question and give you the opportunity to promote where we can find the brewery. We will start in the backwards order of all the questions that were asked, starting with Rob. Rob, what's your final question?
My final question is, why did you write so many papers on Saccharomyces yeast? No, that is not my final question. That is not my final question. Although I did find three papers on Saccharomyces.
Yeah, I got five out there.
So. Five. Wow. Yeah. Okay. I know you've actually already answered this in another article, but I want to see if this still stands. So you were asked, I can't remember where, I think it was on VinePair, about what the best beer of this summer was. And your answer was an IPA from Maine Beer Co. called Thank You. I was wondering if that answer still holds, or is there a change in what your top summer beer was for this year?
Yeah, I had that at the beginning of the summer, and I will hold strong and fast that that was definitely the best beer of the summer. I don't necessarily think that that was my favorite beer of the year. Be on the lookout for another article soon, but that one was definitely my favorite for the summer. Thank You is a great beer. They do every year for their anniversary at Maine Beer Co. I went and visited the brewery there in Freeport. It was just a wonderful experience, and fresh, tank fresh beer was just a wonderful beer. So
there you go.
Daniel.
All right. So since you've been behind so many beer creations and coming up with all these ideas, tell us about what you think is your worst beer idea that you've come up with. What do you think was the biggest failure?
Oh, man.
Maybe not failure. Maybe it just didn't work out as well as you expected.
Which one do you think is the worst one you came up with? Just, yeah.
I mean, worst doesn't necessarily mean bad. It just means worst.
No, I know. At Sweetwater, favorite. You're good. Yeah. And with Sweetwater, we did that G13 beer and the Mango Coast. They were part of a series called 420 strain, where we just basically tried to mimic weed strains in these beers with flavor and aroma. Like the Mango Kush was a wheat beer with Mango Kush. And obviously G13 was like a dank IPA. We did one called Chocolope, which was a stout, like an oatmeal stout with those like hop derived terpenes that smelled like weed. And it was a little weird. I will say, like, the chocolate mixed with the dank, it didn't mesh very well. Surprisingly, what did mesh fairly well, but never made it to large scale distribution was like the gummy bear one. So we did like the terpenes with a kettle sour. That one was awesome. So,
Wendy.
So, if I have never had your beer before, what is the one thing that I should try?
Oh, from the brewery?
Yes.
Cool. Okay. I'm going to give you two because three, actually, because we have three different brands.
Okay.
That works.
Deal.
From Brewery Taru, our sour facility, I would say you have to try Onus on Us, which is our three-year blend of spontaneous beer with full method traditionnel, meaning like turbid mash, four-hour boil with aged hops, spontaneous inoculation in a cool ship, aged in French oak puncheons for 1, 2, and 3 years, and then blended together like a goose. That one is amazing, and it doesn't get enough love. From Offshoot, you know, Relax. It's just the hazy. I think you got to go with the Relax. I think I just saw you pour one.
I just poured one. It's delicious. Yeah.
So it's a basic everyday hazy, but it's really well done, and it's from us here at the brewery, so that you know it's good quality. And I think from the brewery, if I'm going to go with one thing, I would say try one of our anniversary beers, because I think it puts together like all of what we've done with aging. Next year is the 15th year anniversary, which is really exciting. If you guys didn't realize, they're based on the wedding gifts, like Ivory is the 14-year wedding anniversary. So thus Ivoire. We put them in French. Next year's anniversary gift of 15 is Crystal. So the French is Cristal. It's going to be kind of funny. Hopefully we don't get sued.
Hey, you wouldn't be the first brewery. You won't be the last.
Yeah.
So my final questions are, one is a comment, one is a question. I know you guys do a lot of high octane beers, but I would love to see more Kolsch's. Like, can we get like a nice crispy boy in there, like a Kolsch, you know, something that might be a little on the lighter side?
I sent you some Helles.
You did.
I think we actually crushed the lager game too, which is surprising. You know, our Helles lager is probably one of the best lagers that I've had in Southern California. We krause in it, meaning we take some fresh active yeast and combine it with a beer that's at the tail end of fermentation. So it's going to eat up any of those like residual off flavors that are coming that, and it allows us to spund and naturally carbonate the tank as well. So you're going to get like softer bubbles and softer mouthfeel from it. So I think we kind of kill it on the lager game as well.
I'm just saying, with all these high ABV beers, I want some more table beers, some like English milds.
It's almost like you're reading my mind, because I said that same thing when I started here. And now next year, like I said, we got two beers that are sub 4% that are going to come out in January.
Well, we'll have to reconvene here in a few months. My actual final question, very simple. You are in a competition with the entire staff at the brewery, but you get to choose the beer game. What are you choosing to destroy the staff in? Beer pong? You know, it could be beer related, maybe cornhole
Edward
or
40
darts.
Hands.
Edward 40 Hands. Are you a chugger?
I haven't played Edward 40 Hands since undergrad. Holy crap.
That's everyone, but go on.
So I just learned a new one. When I was also in undergrad, I worked in an Irish pub, and I was working in the kitchen, and every night when I would get off, I would just play darts with one of the other kitchen members. And we would sit there for like 3 hours playing darts, drinking pints in this Irish pub. I got really, really good at steel tip darts. And I learned this new game about a year ago, where it sounds really dangerous now that I'm thinking about it, but you sit with a beer can in between your feet, and you're about 10 feet away from two people, and you throw the steel tip dart at the beer can, and as low as you get on the can, the person has to chug until it stops coming out the hole that you made in the beer can.
This sounds like why we lost Jarts back in the 80s, but...
better on draft.
The 80s.
Better on draft does not condone throwing steel darts at other people, just so you guys are aware. That's going to do it. Thank you so much, James, for joining us. The brewery located out in California, they do distribute here in Michigan. Rave is their distributor, which means that if your beer store does not carry them, you can ask them if Rave distributes to them, and therefore you can get it. My name is Ken. For my co-hosts, Dan, Wendy, and Robert, thank you so much for joining. No matter what you think of your beer, we think it's better on draft. Have a good night.
Cheers. Peace.